This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Steve Oney joins us to talk about the lynching of Leo Frank.
An historical turning point in the South where there were literally thousands of lynchings, mostly of black people. This one captured national headlines and spurred the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan.
Attorney Jeff Haas returns to give us an update on the Standing Rock situation.
Listen to this one. You're going to like what he has to say. It looks like we're not losing up there.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In 1913, a 29-year-old New York Jew who managed a pencil factory outside of Atlanta, Georgia, was hauled out of his jail cell in Marietta, Georgia, by a group of prominent citizens, including the judge who found him guilty. He was placed standing on a table. A rope was tied to a tall tree and put around his neck. The judge kicked the table out from under him. Leo Frank was lynched. The case had become a national scandal, with Frank being accused and found guilty of raping and murdering a 13-year-old girl, Mary Fagan, who worked at the pencil factory. Frank was sentenced to death, although he was innocent, but lost his appeals all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. The governor of Georgia, feeling uneasy about the impending execution, commuted the sentence to life in prison. The commutation incited the local citizens to carry out the execution themselves by breaking into Frank's cell and taking him out for the lynching. The Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park City at the southern tip of Manhattan is featuring a show on the Frank case. We speak today with author Stephen Oney, who wrote the definitive book on the subject. It's called And the Dead Shall Rise. Steve Oney, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
Steve, your book is a wonderful book, really the definitive book on the Leo Frank lynching. And I'm so pleased to have you on the program to be able to talk to you about it, because I think it's got a lot of parallels with what's going on in America today. Of course, this went all the way back to 1915. The lynching of Leo Frank took place because of the murder of Mary Fagan. Who was Mary Fagan?
Mary Fagan was a 13-year-old factory laborer, a child laborer, who worked for pennies an hour at a downtown Atlanta pencil factory that churned out hundreds of thousands of pencils a week, a big industrial concern. And she had been working since she was 10 years old. She had an elementary school education, but no hope of going to high school. And this was her life. And on Confederate Memorial Day of 1913, she was brutally murdered at the National Pencil Factory, and therein lies the mystery from which the Leo Frank case sprang.
And who was Leo Frank?
Leo Frank was a Cornell-educated mechanical engineer who was the superintendent of the National Pencil Factory, and he was a cerebral, kind of stiff New York Jew who had come down to the South to run this big industrial concern, and he'd married into an old German Jewish family in Atlanta, and was, you know, part of the assimilated Jewish elite in a city that really had no anti-Semitism. Atlanta and its elite Gentiles and elite Jews were pretty much aligned in running the town. And on the day Mary Fagan was murdered, Frank was the last person to admit having seen her alive. Mary Fagan came into his office to collect her wages, which, you know, was just some pocket change, and he had handed her a small envelope with a couple of quarters and dimes in it, and she asked him as she passed out of his office to leave, has the metal come yet? And she worked in a department that put eraser caps on pencils and then scored the caps so they'd be ready for the erasers to be inserted, and there'd been a shortage in sheet metal at the factory the week of the killing, and Frank, depending on whether you think he's guilty or innocent, told her no, which meant that she left and Frank had nothing to do with the crime, or he said, well, I don't know, let's go see, which meant that he might have grabbed her and taken her back to the metal department and raped and killed her there. So that was a crucial moment of debate, but that's who Frank was. He was a very smart, well-educated, grew up in New York City, in Brooklyn, actually, and just an acculturated German Jew.
What happened at the Atlanta's National Pencil Company on April 26th of 1913?
Well, there again, tremendous mystery, but Mary Fagan was murdered by someone, and her body was dragged to the basement of the factory where it was discovered the next day, and she had been very, very badly beaten up. There was a cord tied around her neck. She died of strangulation. She had cuts and abrasions on her face, and her body itself was coated with grime and soot. The factory basement was filled with coal dust and pencil grindings, and when the responding officers arrived, they couldn't determine whether she was black or white. They had to pull her stockings down to determine that she was a white woman, and the first thing the police officers did was arrest a black night watchman who worked at the factory. I should add that there were two very strange notes that were discovered by Mary Fagan's body that read as if she had jotted them down in her death throes, but were immediately recognizable as fraudulent. One of them said, essentially, "Ma'am, I write while he play with me. That long, tall black Negro did this. I went to make water, and he pushed me down that hole." So the police thought these notes could not possibly have been written by Mary Fagan, and their initial attention focused on the night watchman, a guy named Newt Lee. But they were also pretty quickly suspicious of Leo Frank, because when they called his home, this was early on a Sunday morning, called his home to say that a tragedy had occurred in the pencil factory, he seemed unduly anxious and kept requesting a cup of coffee and seemed to be delaying. And there was something that just struck the police as not right about Frank's response. And it's hard to say whether Frank indeed had something to hide or whether, just as a Jewish guy from New York in the South, confronted by a couple of brusque, good old boy policemen early on a Sunday morning, was put off. And Frank was by nature a pretty nervous guy, so you know, it was out of those kind of mysterious and hard to comprehend encounters that suspicion started to build toward Leo Frank right from the start.
Why was the arrest and the trial of Leo Frank so unusual?
A couple things. First, there was a newspaper war going on in Atlanta at the time. William Randolph Hearst had just bought the third newspaper in Atlanta, the Atlanta Georgian, and he had staffed it with a bunch of guys from New York and Chicago. He was intent on making it into a great urban newspaper like his New York American, and they had been sitting around bored waiting for a big crime to play, and they played the murder very hard and played all the class and religious angles quite hard. Poor working girl, found dead in a pencil factory. So a factory that took advantage of child laborers not only seemed to exploit this particular girl, Mary Fagan, for her miserly wage, but exploited her sexually because this appeared to be a sex crime. And so the city was very overwrought about this. It had never been exposed to the kind of front page journalism that Hearst specialized in. So the populace was virginal. It hadn't developed the kind of cynicism that readers in New York and Chicago might have about front page journalism. And at the same time, though, this case just hit at some very deep seated anxieties of working class people having to send their children into factory settings in order to make ends meet. And Mary Fagan was not alone as a child laborer. Atlanta had many, many factories that ran on child labor. So there was great upset about that. And then there was, many of the readers jumped to the next conclusion, which was that a Ivy League educated Jewish factory boss would, of course, be exploitative of the poor Gentile kids who worked in his factory. So all that led up to a trial in July and August in a hot, unventilated, oppressive courtroom where the case just spun out of control. And finally, the element that took it into cloud cuckoo land was that the key witness against Leo Frank was a black factory janitor named Jim Conley. And Jim Conley testified in court and prior to that in a couple of affidavits that Leo Frank had murdered Mary Fagan and that Leo Frank had killed her because she had resisted his sexual advances and that then Leo Frank had dictated to Jim Conley those strange notes found by Mary Fagan's body and ordered Conley to place the notes by the body in order to cast suspicion on yet another black guy in the factory. And Conley gave 3 days of testimony to this point at the trial, and while he contradicted himself quite often, he was never broken by a very vicious defense cross-examination. And what happened in the courtroom was that an all-white jury found itself in the unusual position in the Deep South in 1913 of convicting a white man largely on the testimony of a black star witness. And so a white jury found the black witness's testimony far more credible than Leo Frank's story, which was that Mary Fagan had simply appeared in his office to get her pay on the day that she lost her life, and that he never saw her again and never thought about her again until he heard from the police that she was dead.
Well, how did the Frank case become a nationwide cause célèbre?
Well, after Leo Frank was convicted, and he was convicted quickly, and there was a huge citywide celebration the night of his conviction. People standing in skyscrapers throwing confetti onto the streets, and the prosecuting attorney, a guy named Hugh Dorsey, was picked up like a football hero and carried from the courtroom to his car. It was just mayhem. After witnessing that, the rabbi of Atlanta's primary synagogue called the Temple, its chief reform synagogue, his name was David Marks, he got on a train and went to New York and met with some of the leaders of America's Jewish community to alert them to what he thought was an anti-Semitic prosecution and an anti-Semitic arrest. And he met with Adolf Ox, the publisher of the New York Times. He met with Louis Marshall, who was executive chairman of the American Jewish Committee. And he met with a Chicago advertising guy named A.D. Lasker and essentially said, "Gentlemen, we may think we have no anti-Semitism in America, but there is a terrific incident of it that just occurred." And initially, Lasker, Ox, and Marshall were resistant to David Marks. They didn't want to make this a case about Jewishness. They wanted to make it a case about innocence. But over time, they came to the conclusion that this was indeed had indeed been an anti-Semitic prosecution. So the New York Times, most particularly, did something it had never done before and has never done since, really. It became part of an advocacy journalism effort to exonerate Leo Frank, and it turned over not only its editorial pages to Frank's calls, but its news pages, and day after day wrote big stories championing Leo Frank's innocence and putting them on its front page. And this transformed what had been a gruesome and horrific but still regional murder case into a national case in which in every big city in America there were discussions and mass public meetings and petition drives. And as a consequence, there was a backlash in Georgia against what Georgians called outside interference. So you had brewing a high-pressure and low-pressure front about to meet, and the unleashing of an extraordinarily pent-up amount of energy around this case.
Which brings me to a question about Tom Watson. Who was he, and what role did he play in the case?
Well, Tom Watson was the chief spokesman against Leo Frank. Tom Watson had no role in Leo Frank's trial, had no part in his conviction, but after this case became a national cause célèbre, Watson decided that he would single-handedly rebut the New York Times. And Watson had been a United States congressman. He was a brilliant speaker. He'd run for vice president in 1896 as William Jennings Bryan's running mate on the Populist Party ticket. And he believed he spoke for the poor man, the common man, the poor dirt farmer, and he was a very eloquent champion of that class of Southerners. And in the Frank case, he saw influence and power and capitalism up against a poor child laborer who had been brutally ground down. And he also, Watson was a bit unusual for his time in the South. He was in a way a champion of black rights. So he also felt that the black witness against Leo Frank had been mistreated. So Watson used all of his rhetorical skills and a weekly newspaper called the Jeffersonian to rebut the New York Times week after week. And the Jeffersonian was a struggling little weekly with only a circulation of about 20,000 when Watson got started. But Watson was on fire on this issue, and over the course of the next year and a half, the circulation of the paper nearly quadrupled, and Watson felt himself to be the instrument of Southern resistance against this outside interference represented by the New York Times.
Why was the lynching of Leo Frank unique?
Well, Leo Frank's conviction was upheld all the way to the United States Supreme Court. So it was litigated every step of the way, and a complicated and important Supreme Court case based on an early use of the 14th Amendment to champion Frank's cause. And, you know, that's now the regular way that murder cases are fought, or very often murder convictions are fought in the Supreme Court. But Frank was, he lost his final appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The case came back to the governor of Georgia, John Slayton, and John Slayton commuted Leo Frank's death sentence to life imprisonment. And John Slayton made, I think, a very courageous decision. However, John Slayton had a conflict of interest. He was law partners with Frank's lead attorney, a guy named Luther Rosser. So when Slayton commuted Frank's death sentence, all hell broke loose in Georgia. There were mass demonstrations. A mob took over the state capitol. Another mob marched on Slayton's mansion, and the National Guard was called out to restore order. And almost immediately, a cadre of very influential people began plotting how to lynch Leo Frank. And there were 22 lynchings in Georgia in 1915. They were all blacks, except for Leo Frank. And most of those lynchings occurred spontaneously and were like strikes of heat lightning. The Leo Frank lynching was a calculated act of derring do in which this cadre of men from a little town, Marietta, which is just northwest of Atlanta and was Mary Fagan's ancestral home, this group of men plotted to abduct Leo Frank from the state prison, which was down in Milledgeville, Georgia, in the heart of the state, about 150 miles, depending on the route you drive, from Marietta. So this group from Marietta plotted, schemed, greased skids, and created the environment necessary to abduct Leo Frank bloodlessly, without a shot being fired, from the state prison, and then drive him in a caravan of cars in the dead of night up through the gut of Georgia back to Marietta and lynch him at dawn on August 17th, 1915. So what made the Frank lynching different than any other lynching is that it was an act of brilliant premeditation, and no one in the lynch party was ever inconvenienced other than losing a night's sleep. No one was ever prosecuted. It was a perfect crime, and for, you know, some 90 years, most of the names, although they were well-known within Marietta, most of the names of the people involved were never printed or circulated because they were very powerful people. I typically do not believe in conspiracies. I think they're too difficult to carry out, and life is more random. And yet this was a true conspiracy in which a group of powerful Marietta men decided to game the state prison system and abduct and lynch this, by this point, very, very famous national, they saw, murderer and rapist and criminal.
And they got away with it. But in the meantime, in the aftermath of the Frank lynching, two diametrically opposed and lasting forces in American life came into existence. What are they?
Well, Frank was lynched in August of 1915, and on Thanksgiving Eve of 1915, about 2 months later, the Ku Klux Klan was revitalized at a cross burning atop Stone Mountain, which is a gigantic granite outcropping just east of Atlanta, about 20 miles away from the lynch site. And the Klan had been in quiescence since home rule was restored to the South following the military occupation after the Civil War. There had been, you know, a sentimental longing for the Klan, but the Klan, as it had been initially put together by Nathan Bedford Forrest, was no more. But the Klan was reconstituted on Thanksgiving Eve, 1915. Several members of the lynch party were said to be at this cross burning, although it's impossible to nail that down. And the Klan that we know and love today was born out of that night. So born out of the Frank lynching, also born out of the 1915 premiere of the movie Birth of a Nation, which celebrated the original Klan and was premiering, opening on a kind of staggered schedule all across America during 1915. And, you know, then the Klan was further fueled at the end of World War One when black soldiers who'd been given a degree of dignity while serving in Europe came back to America and wanted the same treatment. And so there was, you know, kind of a witch's brew of influences that led to the Klan reasserting itself. Simultaneously, the Anti-Defamation League, which was actually formed in 1913 but really didn't have anything to do, the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith started to take anti-Semitism in America seriously, and the Frank lynching galvanized the Anti-Defamation League and is really seen as giving the Anti-Defamation League its shape and form, although the group itself was constituted a couple years earlier. The lynching is what brought it to its incarnation we have today.
Well, Steve, this is really, really interesting, and I would urge our listeners who live in Manhattan to go down to the Museum of Jewish Heritage and check out the really powerful show that they have about the Leo Frank incident. But I wanted to ask you, in closing, how is America of 2016 like the America of 1915? It's been 101 years. How is it today like it was the year that Frank was murdered?
I hate to say it, but I think the America of 2016 and the America of 1915 are very much alike. And in 1915, you had the Agrarian Age ending, and you had the exceptional anxiety created by the beginning of the Industrial Age. And so people were stumbling as they tried to enter into this new economy of machines and assembly lines, and they felt confused and befuddled and frightened. And the America of today, of course, faces a similar transition from the industrial to the information age. And that just sounds like words, but it's not. I think there's a underlying fear and befuddlement in both 1915 and 2016 that makes the climate particularly attractive to demagoguery, to scapegoating, to, you know, the most radical kind of insensitive statements. And Tom Watson played that role in 1915. Now, Tom Watson was actually a very smart guy, a lawyer, a publisher. He would profit from the lynching of Leo Frank and be elected to the United States Senate. He would die in office in the 1920s. Donald Trump plays on some of those same anxieties in 2015. To compare Trump to Watson does a disservice to Watson, because Watson was a brilliant rhetorician who spoke in perfect sentences, and, you know, you could parse the sentences and you might find them filled with hate, but you would at least admire the structure. Trump is, you know, for the Twitter age, you know, the equivalent. So it doesn't take much for the horsemen of the apocalypse to get out of the barn. And that's what happened with the lynching of Leo Frank. And I'm not saying it'll happen again, but people must be smart and thoughtful. And, you know, we all are prejudiced and we all have our fears and anxieties, but I think it's always good to stop and think before you speak and, you know, try to be rational instead of emotional. I mean, luckily we don't have a case like the Mary Fagan murder today that would bring all these elements into alignment. And I also, the one way America may be unlike the America of 2015, we're now so distracted and atomized. In 1915, because there wasn't even radio yet, there were just the newspapers and the newsreels and movies, the entire country could get interested in one legal case. And now we have cases that we get interested in, Ferguson et al., for 3 weeks, 4 weeks, but they pass away and something else seizes our attention. So we're more distracted today than we were in 1915, but I think we're equally unnerved, and that's frightening.
Yeah, sure is. We've been speaking with Steve Oney, the author of the great book on the Leo Frank lynching. It's called And the Dead Shall Rise. Steve, it's been very good for us to be able to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you. We encourage people to go to the Museum of the Jewish Heritage in Battery Park City and check out the Leo Frank exhibit. And we encourage them to read the book, The Dead Shall Rise Again. Steve, you take it easy.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Dakota Access Pipeline, which is planned to bring dirty shale oil through North Dakota and underneath the Missouri River into the Midwest, has been stalled by a powerful occupation of representatives of some 180 Native American tribes and several thousand supporters who are camped out in North Dakota. The pipeline is being constructed by a Texas company. It's a $3.8 billion project financed by bank loans from, among others, Goldman Sachs, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and UBS Bank. The amount of air pollution by not keeping this oil in the hole is substantial and will contribute substantially to global warming. Moreover, if the pipe breaks under the river, as these pipelines frequently do, it could pollute the drinking water of up to 20 million people who depend on it. We speak again today with one of the lead attorneys for the protesters, Jeff Haas. He practices environmental law and is a member of the National Lawyers Guild.
Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, before we ask you for an update, for listeners who were just tuning in on the situation, can you, in a nutshell, tell us the background?
The background is that the Dakota Access Pipeline is a pipeline that wants to deliver oil from the Bakken oil fields in western North Dakota to the Midwest and then possibly the Gulf. It's owned by two large pipeline companies, Enbridge, which we all are familiar with, and energy transfer partners. Anyway, it goes through Native American land, sacred sites, and crosses the Missouri twice and the Mississippi. So the potential for leaks is enormous, and if successful, it would deliver 500,000 barrels of oil a day, which we don't need. So the tribes whose land is actually threatened and whose sacred sites are threatened by the pipeline have encamped a few miles west of the Missouri River on the next to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe Reservation. And they've determined to stop the DAPL because of the fact that it threatens their water. It goes under the Missouri River right above where they take their water supply. It also has already destroyed several sacred sites. And also, they don't want to pollute the air, and they want to keep it in the ground. So the stand by Native American tribes, and the Standing Rock tribe is joined by seven other branches of the Sioux Nation. And now this encampment, which has grown as large as 7,000 or 8,000 at different times, is digging in, and water protectors from the camp are going out and interrupting the construction of the pipeline. And there have been several confrontations, some of which were dramatically captured by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now, when security dogs for the Dakota Access Pipeline actually were unleashed on some of the water protectors who were trying to protect one of the sacred sites. So that's a little bit of the background, and it's garnered national and international support. The leaders of the tribe have been to Geneva, and I think it's become a big issue nationally. And actually, the Obama administration issued an executive order right when the confrontation was going on a month ago, and actually withdrew the permit for the pipeline to go under the Missouri River and the nearby lake. That's only a temporary withdrawal, and even though they recommended that the pipeline cease building for the short time, the pipeline and the owners are determined to continue, and the encampment is determined to stop it.
Haven't there been some confrontations and arrests in the last 2 weeks since we spoke with you?
There have been a number of confrontations and arrests, I think about over 60. And what happens is the water protectors, people go out from the encampment and see wherever the construction is going on, and they stand in the way of the construction equipment, or they lock down on the construction equipment. They have a very safe way of locking their arms with pipes through the equipment so that it can't move, and they have to be removed in a special way. So they've actually successfully stopped construction on many days. For example, on Monday, a caravan of 110 cars left the camp with the intent of finding wherever the construction was going on and stopping it. When the helicopter for the pipeline saw them leave camp, rather than have another confrontation, they just closed down construction for the day, and there were no arrests. So it's really a sort of a standoff there, and the people are determined not to allow the pipeline to be built. It is it's now October, and I think, being North Dakota, if they can stop the pipeline from being constructed up until November when the ground freezes 6 feet deep, they may have to stop the construction at least until spring. On the other hand, the pipeline, which has borrowed money, and it's a $3.8 billion pipeline, is anxious to get it to finish it and to make their profits. And most recently, not only in North Dakota, but now in Iowa, there's a group of resistors also right on the Mississippi River, and they've encamped there, and they've encountered, I think they had about 20 arrests a couple of days ago. So there's resistance to this pipeline going all up and down its length from North Dakota now to Illinois. But the main thing is this amazing coming together of tribes. Over 200 tribes have been at the Standing Rock camp, camped there, set their flags there, and have taken the position that water is life, and they will not accept a pipeline which threatens their water supply.
When people get arrested there, do they have adequate legal defense from attorneys?
Well, the National Lawyers Guild has really brought a number of attorneys up there, and so we have a sort of a revolving door of guild attorneys who come in and help people and actually interview them in the jail. Unfortunately, North Dakota law is very tough about allowing out-of-state lawyers to represent people in court. So we're in the process of working with two or three North Dakota lawyers and helping them, giving them the information on people arrested and having them actually stand up in the bond court. And three or four lawyers are seeking admission to the North Dakota bar so they can actually do the criminal cases.
Jeff, what kind of legal arguments are you raising to try to stop the pipeline?
Well, I think the legal arguments were the analysis that was done, which gave them the overall permit. There was just an environmental analysis, which is a sort of superficial way of determining how the overall environment is affected, instead of an environmental impact statement, which is much deeper. And the Army Corps of Engineers gave an overall permit originally, doing a very superficial investigation of the effects of the pipeline on water in particular. Leaks and spills are very common on these pipelines. The fact that it goes under the Missouri River, which has the drinking water for 15 million people, is just one example. Also, they are required under law to see the effect on the sacred sites and burial grounds of Native Americans. Again, they did a very superficial site. And as a matter of fact, a few weeks ago, right after an archaeologist had discovered three historical sites, both grave sites and reproductions of astronomical bodies that were done by Native American tribes centuries ago, the next day the pipeline bulldozed that area. And that was the day that the dogs were brought out by the security guards. So there's really been a failure of the government to work with the tribes. They're under international and U.S. law to get the approval of the tribes before they do this. They did not do that investigation. And so both from an environmental standpoint and a sacred site standpoint, we think the pipeline does not comply with U.S. law or international law.
Jeff, in terms of defenses that the protesters themselves might raise, have any invoked the necessity defense?
Well, they have an excuse defense in North Dakota, which is probably maybe even a little easier to get to, but can include the same thing. No one has gone to trial yet up there. Everybody's out on bond. I think there are about 85 misdemeanors and 7 felony cases. Originally, we're charging people who locked down on equipment with misdemeanor criminal damage to property. Now they've upped it to reckless endangerment. There's a lot of legal possible defenses. The criminal trespass charges are really subject to whose land is it? Does the pipeline, for example, that might have a easement have a right to evict people? There were a number of other defenses that I think come up, both on the right to be at the land, and there are a number of other legal defenses in terms of reckless endangerment. The statute requires that you actually endanger and sort of intentionally endanger yourself or someone else, and it's belied by the fact that this is nonviolent direct action, and they go out of their way not to harm themselves or to harm other people. So the question of whether this reckless endangerment is accurately describes what's been done is certainly a big question.
And you had mentioned the harsh winters, which we know about. What are the plans of the protesters as winter draws near?
Well, I was just speaking to one of the women lawyers, the regular lawyer. She said she woke up in the tent this morning. It was 27 degrees wind chill, and this is just the beginning of October. There are plans, and they're actually being put into effect, to probably move the main camp to a little bit south to the town of Cannonball, which would also be on the Standing Rock Reservation. Currently, the camp is on Army Corps of Engineers ground. It's also not protected. It's pretty open area. So they've gotten a number of winterized tents, and they're in the process of moving kitchens and so forth. I just learned that they're calling October a transitional month in which the main camp will be moved, and exactly where it's going to be is in the process of being worked out right now. But it would only be a few, maybe a couple of miles south of where it is right now.
For listeners who may have just tuned in, we're speaking with Attorney Jeff Haas, who's been regularly out there in North Dakota leading the defense of the people who are trying to prevent the pipeline from being constructed. Jeff, what do you hope it'll happen? That, you know, there's a lot of money at stake here. You know, what are your hopes about trying to stop it?
Well, like we said, they have a $3.8 billion pipeline. They've borrowed money from a number of banks, including Wells Fargo and Bank of America. So they're under a deadline, too, to proceed and make it profitable. And on the other hand, I think the commitment of the people up there to stop it, to make it to create a national issue, not just around Native American sovereignty and sacred sites, but around water and around our air and around the planet and the next generations. Because if with this 500,000 gallons of oil, if we can keep it in the ground in North Dakota, that's like keeping 20 million cars off the road. So I don't know how it's going to play out. You know, I think there's been a lot of support. I think politically, I think 19 representatives introduced a bill to in Congress to oppose the DAPL. On the other hand, there's a lot of determination and a lot of money on the other side that, you know, sees the extraction and transmission of oil as very profitable. So you really have two sides locked in a pretty serious battle and confrontation.
Jeff, considering Hillary Clinton's closeness to financial institutions, especially Goldman Sachs, and her previous position and support for fracking, how do you think she will act if she's elected?
Well, people have asked her to come to Standing Rock, and she's not there yet. And I think that's a really good question. And she also is someone who is not opposed to fracking. And this is fracked oil and gas from North Dakota. So I think maybe she'll respond based on who puts the most pressure on her. Is it going to be the financial, the banks, or the pipelines, or is it going to be the people and the tribes and those who are really serious about, see the seriousness of climate change? And I think that's going to be an interesting, you know, I don't think she's going to do the right thing unless a lot of pressure is put on her around the issues of water and climate and native sovereignty.
It would be a good debate question.
Yeah, I wish you would have been the person that asked the questions at the debates.
What do you think about the DAPL? That would be a very good question.
It was kind of a thought experiment. We were talking to your friend Bill Ayers last week, and he gave a talk about his new book, Demand the Impossible. And they were so frustrated in the audience that nobody asked any good questions of Trump or Clinton. And one of the questions was, what would you do about the DAPL? But nobody's asking them. You know, nobody's putting them on the spot, and they're not talking about it.
No, they screen those questions so clearly. And, you know, all these debates, you don't come up with the really important questions.
Well, Jeff, this has been a great update. We really appreciate your being with us over the last several weeks.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I understand that you have Richard Olney on coming up.
Yes, we do, Jeff. Steve Olney wrote the book, you know, the book. There have been movies and a play about the Leo Frank lynching back in your home city, in Atlanta, Georgia, right outside Atlanta, Georgia. And your grandfather was involved in that. He also was an attorney, Herbert Haas.
Herbert, right.
And we wanted to ask you about that because just fortuitously, you're a friend and a colleague, and you also have a connection to the Leo Frank lynching. So what was it like for you growing up in that family and knowing about it and being Jewish and living in Atlanta?
Well, like you said, my grandfather, Herbert Haas, was a lawyer in Atlanta. And when Leo Frank was first arrested, he called my grandfather, Herbert Haas. And my grandfather was not a criminal lawyer, a criminal defense lawyer, so he actually played a role in bringing together lawyers who defended Leo Frank. Quickly, Leo Frank was framed up for the murder of a young Protestant girl at the plant, the Atlanta Pencil Company, where he was the manager. And Steve can tell you more about the whole case, but really it was an anti-Semitic thing, and Leo Frank had been brought down from New York to manage the company, and it was portrayed as a Jewish ritual crime. Leo Frank actually ended up being lynched outside of Atlanta, not by a lynch mob, but by some of the most prominent families in Atlanta. I grew up hearing about the story when my grandfather, Herbert Haas, was his lawyer, and I learned that he actually had a private detective watching his home when his daughter was born, because there was so much anger built up by the Hearst papers about this Jew from New York who had come down and murdered this young Protestant girl, supposedly. Of course, the evidence actually pretty much proved that somebody else did it. But nevertheless, the papers picked it up, and Leo Frank was convicted in an atmosphere of hate, with the people at the trial were threatening to stone the jury if they didn't come back with a guilty verdict. When they did, he got the death penalty, and the governor of Georgia actually commuted his sentence to life, and then Leo Frank was actually lynched after that. My family, my grandfather, was traumatized by it. The whole Jewish community was traumatized by it. This happened in 1913, and I think he was lynched in 1914 or 15. And the Jewish community, my grandfather never wanted to talk about it. I was pretty proud that he had represented Leo Frank. And even my father, Joseph Haas, who was a lawyer, was still somewhat hesitant to talk about the case. I went to school in Atlanta 50 years later with the grandchildren of the aristocratic Georgia politicians who had actually put together the lynching of Leo Frank. So that was odd. My grandfather would never talk to any of those people later. But what was also interesting was whereas in 19, when this happened, the Jewish community was afraid to speak out. That same year that Leo Frank was lynched, I think there were 14 black people lynched in Georgia, and the white community didn't say anything about it. So there was a mix. Jews felt precarious. Both they were targets, but they also didn't necessarily stick their necks out to stand up for black people. Years later, when the temple, which I belonged to, was bombed because the rabbi had supported Dr. King, there was a different response, and the next Saturday, or the next Sabbath for services, the entire congregation stood up. Of course, that was 50 years later. So that's just some interesting history of anti-Semitism in Atlanta. And the Leo Frank case caused the creation of the Anti-Defamation League, which did a lot of work, human rights work, for various groups up until fairly recently, in which they seem to have forgotten about the human rights of Palestinians and have become sort of a cheering squad for Israeli human rights abuses. But anyway, that also historically dates to the Leo Frank case.
You know, I think there's some parallels now, particularly with Donald Trump running and his scapegoating immigrants. And Jews were seen, I think, as outsiders, ironically, because they had been in Atlanta starting in 1845. In fact, there were a lot of Jews in Atlanta that supported the Confederacy during the Civil War. So they were part of the South, but they were seen as outsiders, and particularly Leo Frank, an Ivy League Cornell-educated guy that comes down, he's born in Brooklyn, comes down. And I think that there are parallels between the stirring up of fear about immigrants that Trump is doing and the stirring up of fear about Jewish outsiders down there in Georgia.
I think you're right. And the Hearst papers picked up the Leo Frank story and fanned the flames. And there was a local Atlanta paper that also did the same thing, that played on the fears and the anti-Semitic feelings and the religious sentiment in the South, and built up this whole myth. So yeah, there are similarities. I think every group has gone that's come in as an immigrant has had mythology about it, and it still continues with immigrants and black people and brown people and so forth.
Yeah, I think from the very beginning there's been an effort to keep this country white, starting with the genocide against the Indians.
And now we have Fox Media and conservative press fanning the flames as well.
It's dangerous, and everybody understands the key words, and I think Trump uses them sometimes carefully and sometimes not carefully. But the message is pretty clear. We want to make America great again, as we want white supremacy to rule without challenge again.
Absolutely. Well, Jeff, we've come to the end of our allotted time, so regretfully, we have to say goodbye for now. But we want to keep you in our pipeline and talk to you soon and get some more updates from you on what's going on in North Dakota. But in the meantime...
All right. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you all.
Thank you, Jeff.
You be well, and we'll speak to you soon. Thank you,
Stay
Jeff
safe.
Haas, for being on Law
Thank
and Disorder.
You.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again... go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.